I'm Russell Brooks, and this is number 0458 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0458. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet research geophysicist Dr. Michael Poland from the Cascades Volcano Observatory. He talks about the recent eruption of Hawaii's Kilauea. How long could these eruptions last?
I think the volcanological community has gotten fairly good at forecasting when eruptive activity might start or have some major changes, but I think we still don't have much experience with forecasting when things are going to end, just because it's a much more chaotic process. The best indications of how long this might go are coming from past experience. There were eruptions in the same area in 1955 and in 1960, and those eruptions lasted weeks to months, so that's probably the scenario we're looking at here.
Dr. David Trock is the author of his memoir, The 11th Commandment. Before he turned his life around, he was a teenage gang leader.
The nun told me about a problem that existed in a grade school. See, we didn't have school buses in those days. Children couldn't get to the Catholic school because of a gang that was harassing them. So, actually, I had about three guys initially involved with me. And so we set up an elaborate plan with a pyrogenic guy and found the headquarters of the opposing gang and blew it up.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. The Book Banter sort of goes on the campaign trail as veteran reporter Amy Chozick recounts her experiences covering Hillary Clinton's White House run with Chasing Hillary. So get ready to board the press bus once again. It's leaving soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0458 was author Russell Brooks, whose latest book is the thriller The Demeter Code. And you can check out his website at russellparkway.com. That's russellparkway.com. And you'll find a link to his website on the Stuff File page, which Russell just mentioned. See how this all goes around full circle? It's amazing, isn't it? Thank you very much, Russell, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, some people say there are too many guns in America, and it's hard to argue the point when stray firearms are literally falling around the expressways. A driver who spotted a black object flying through the air on a Washington highway stopped 18 miles later and found a handgun embedded in his bumper. Washington State Patrol Trooper Guy Gill said the man was driving on Interstate 5 when he saw the object fly through the air and appear to strike his bumper. The man told troopers he didn't think the object had struck his bumper very hard, and no warning lights came on, so he decided not to stop and investigate. Gill said the man stopped at a gas station about 18 miles later and discovered the handgun lodged, barrel first, in his front bumper. Gill said it was one of the strangest things he had seen in his 23 years on the job. The gun was turned over to Lakewood Police. You know, I'm guessing most people think that the gun was tossed from an overpass or perhaps a passing vehicle. But if you listen to what the NRA keeps telling everyone about the U.S. Second Amendment, then you know gun ownership is a God-given right. So maybe someone out there was praying for a gun, and their prayers were answered. It literally just fell from the heavens. It's possible. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. Okay, here's another reoccurring story that keeps popping up on the Stuff File News. You may recall the story of a man who burned down his garage with a torch while trying to melt icicles. You may also remember a previous story where another guy burned down his garage trying to destroy a wasp's nest. Well, here's the latest incarnation. This time, it's man versus weeds. Authorities in Ohio said a man attempting to use a torch to kill weeds in his yard ended up setting his garage on fire. Firefighters said the homeowner told investigators he was trying to kill the weeds around his detached garage with a torch, and the structure caught fire accidentally. No injuries were reported. The garage was considered a total loss, with damages estimated at $10,000 to $15,000. Yes, I know it was a costly fire, but let's look at the bright side, shall we? He no longer has a weed problem. Yeah. In 2016, Su Yun went on vacation and returned home with a new family pet. She and her family thought they were getting a Tibetan Mastiff, but it kept eating, a box of fruits and two buckets of noodles every day. It also kept growing and eating and growing. The more he grew, the more he looked like a bear, she said, and I am a little scared of bears. The family reached out to the Yunnan Wildlife Rescue Center, whose workers may have been more than a little scared. They sedated the Asiatic black bear before taking it away from the home in a village near Kunming, Yunnan, China, where it had lived with Su Yun and her family. Yeah, it's a little scary. Also quite fortunate that they brought home a bear that was willing to be a vegetarian. And by the way, if you can't tell the difference between a puppy and a bear cub, you don't need to get out more. You need to read more. Or at the very least, look up Google Images. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, you know how we do love our truck spills on this show. Well, here's the latest one. A tractor trailer made a foul mess when it rolled over in Washington State. It dumped over 40,000 pounds of chicken feathers across Interstate 5. Yes, Washington State Patrol Trooper Rick Johnson said the driver told investigators he fell asleep at about 3:30 a.m. north of Tacoma and lost control of the truck, which hit a guardrail and overturned. Aw, maybe he needed a feather pillow. The truck was hauling the feathers from a poultry facility to a rendering company in Vancouver, British Columbia. The Canadian company recycles animal byproducts into ingredients for items including pet food and soap. Traffic was backed up for 11 miles as crews scooped up the feathers. Johnson said the driver would be cited for negligent driving. Wow. 40,000 pounds of chicken feathers. That means somewhere around the point of origin of the truck, there are a whole lot of naked chickens. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? For the last couple of weeks, Kilauea has been erupting on the Big Island of Hawaii, generating earthquakes and producing gushing molten rock, giant ash plumes, and sulfur dioxide. It has destroyed many buildings and forced thousands from their homes. To talk a little bit about what this could possibly mean for the area's future, we are joined by Dr. Michael Poland, who is a research geophysicist with the Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver, Washington. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Watching this stuff play out on the news on a daily basis is rather harrowing. And at this time that we are recording this, what do we know as far as how long this will last and what effect it will have in the future?
Well, that's a really good question. I think the volcanological community has gotten fairly good at forecasting when eruptive activity might start. Or have some major changes. But I think we still don't have much experience with forecasting when things are going to end, just because it's a much more chaotic process. The best indications of how long this might go are coming from past experience. There were eruptions in the same area in 1955 and in 1960, and those eruptions lasted weeks to months, so that's probably the scenario we're looking at here.
Now, recently the lava had reached down to the ocean, which is where it then caused these plumes of smoke and also literally added new land to the island. Let's go back to those two previous eruptions you mentioned earlier, 1955 and 1960. What was the after effect of those eruptions?
Well, they did cover quite a bit of area in lava. The 1955 one was similar to the one that's occurring now in that there was many fissures that were active, and lava flowed from those fissures to the southeast and entered the ocean. The 1960 eruption, unfortunately, inundated the village of Kapoho and destroyed it over the course of several weeks. It also created quite a bit of new land on the eastern tip of the island. So, unfortunately, this corner of the island has all too much experience with eruptions happening in populated areas.
Well, that's the point I wanted to get to. You say it created quite a bit of new land. Over a period of time, how habitable is that land?
Well, it's a tough call because it depends on so many factors. One of the big hazards in the area at Kilauea is the lava ocean entry. There's that plume that you mentioned, which is not good for your health if you're right in the thick of it. It dissipates quickly, so it's not a very widespread hazard. But more importantly is the deltas of lava that get built out into the ocean are extremely unstable. They're basically these fragmented piles of lava that are underlain by sand and being pounded by waves from the ocean. And they can collapse without warning at any time. If you're anywhere near it, then you might get hit with rock that's part of this collapse that's flying through the air. Or if you're on it and it collapses, then, of course, you'll be dragged out to the ocean. So it takes quite a while before lava that goes into the ocean can really be considered stable. And so that's something that we'll have to just see how that evolves over the course of this eruption.
With this current eruption, who needs to be concerned right now?
Well, residents that are in the area are the ones that are most need to be aware of what's going on. Lava flows are extremely fast moving right now, quite dynamic. They can change direction. One of the really difficult things about forecasting how lava flows will behave is that they make their own topography. You can probably see this in some of the videos of the eruption, that already there's cones forming and spatter ramparts. This affects the way lava flows travel, so they're not going to follow these predefined paths towards the ocean or downslope, because those paths are always changing because the lava is filling up valleys and gullies and things like that. So it's very important that people that are in the area be very aware of where lava is because it may change direction at any time. There's also hazards due to gases. An eruption that's this vigorous is putting out a lot of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. And if you're close to one of the eruptive vents and the wind shifts, then it could blow this plume of sulfur dioxide in a direction that might impact some residents. Close to the vents, it can be very unhealthy to be in that plume.
As you just described, unlike water, lava does not necessarily travel the path of least resistance.
No. It generally will flow downslope, but it also is not water and is very viscous fluid, so it can sort of move around a bit in ways that might be a bit unexpected. And especially once those initial flows are in place, then they create new barriers. They essentially can divert themselves from pathways that they might otherwise be taking. So it's a phenomena that we're trying to grapple with in terms of forecasting which way lava flows go. We're fairly good at forecasting pathways for the initial flows, but for subsequent flows after that first stage of emplacement, you've got to get updated topographic information. And it turns out that that's actually pretty hard to get on a consistent basis. We're working with all kinds of different technologies to try to do that so we can better forecast how flows might work after that initial pulse is in place.
Getting back to that lava haze for a second that is hitting the water and causing dense white clouds of steam, one of the things it's throwing up into the air too is tiny shards of volcanic glass. Can you describe what exactly that is?
Yeah, that's actually fragments of lava. So as the lava impacts the ocean, comes into contact with the ocean, the cold ocean water fragments the lava completely. It quenches it, just like quenching liquid glass. And that causes the lava to fragment, sort of shatter. And bits of these shattered pieces of volcanic glass are wafted up into the plume. So not only the plume of hot and acidic steam, it also contains these bits of glass particles that are coming from the shattering of lava in the surf.
Now, as you say, this is a situation you can't necessarily predict, but here we are in the middle of what is an ongoing eruption. As someone like yourself, who is a geologist, what are you learning? What is the scientific community learning by what's going on right now in Kilauea?
Well, we're learning an awful lot about the way these eruptions evolve. We've been tracking how magma was moving underground prior to this activity by looking at earthquakes and by looking at how the ground is moving. And so we've got quite a few new insights into the subsurface plumbing of this particular area. We've also seen some interesting results in the geochemistry, the composition of the lava that's coming out, in that we can see that some of the material that came out first is actually quite old. It actually looks like lava that was erupted in 1955. So that suggests that there are these pods of old magma sitting around underground. And as fresh magma came from the summit area of the volcano, which is about 40 kilometers away, it intersected these old pods and pushed them out first. And that's why some of the first activity that we saw was sort of weak spattering. The flows didn't go very far. It wasn't very vigorous. The really vigorous activity we've seen over the last several days, that's a sign of fresh magma making it to the surface. It seems to have flushed out all of this older stuff. So we're learning an awful lot about the plumbing system of these rift zones that are characterizing Kilauea.
And while you can't predict when one will take place, can you explain why it's taking place?
Yeah, we do know what happened here. And actually, we knew that something was going to be happening at Kilauea weeks in advance. The former erupt event, which was called Pu'uo'o, it's about 20 kilometers from the current eruption site. In March, Pu'uo'o started to inflate, like pressure was building beneath it, like a balloon was inflating. And we think that was because there was less lava coming out. So basically, the whole system was starting to back up because someone kinked the lava hose. Pressure then started to build at the summit, so the whole thing started to back up. And you might recall in April, there were some really spectacular videos of lava coming out at the summit and filling a crater there. So the whole system was pressurizing. We've seen that sort of thing happen in the past to Kilauea. It's always before resulted in an eruptive event that's maybe only a few kilometers from Pu'uo'o. That's all in the national park, all in an unpopulated area. All of the houses in that area, they've already been destroyed. So there's always a weak link in the system that seems to rupture when this pressure builds. This time, the weak link seems to have been the barrier that kept lava from going further down the east rift zone into a more populated part of the island. And that time, that's the weak link that broke. And that's why we're in the situation we're in now.
We've been hearing reports, and you're telling me they're erroneous, of this being part of the ring of fire and that it's a chain reaction situation. But you're saying that's not the case.
Yeah, not at all. The Ring of Fire is describing the Pacific Rim, California up to Alaska, around to Kamchatka, Japan, down towards the Philippines, Indonesia. And this is all created by the tectonic situation of the region, that there are tectonic plates that are sinking beneath other plates, and that's what causes the earthquakes and volcanoes around the Pacific Rim. Hawaii is a hotspot volcano, which is driven by a deep melting anomaly that originates within the Earth and sort of burns through the center of the tectonic plate. So it's unrelated to what's happening on the Pacific Rim. And we have heard a lot of people wondering if there are connections between what's happening in Hawaii and, say, explosions that are happening at Merapi in Indonesia, or a geyser going off in Yellowstone. And I think a lot of these reasons that people want to see connections, it's mostly psychological, that we see these things in the news, and you know, typically they're reported in the same breath that there's an eruption in Hawaii, and by the way, there's also an eruption in Indonesia. So I think our brains want to draw conclusions, but we know that physically there's no connection between these processes. The distances are too great, and the activity that's driving these eruptions is completely different. So it seems to be more of a psychological effect than anything that's real.
And finally, the last one was in 1960. Before that, in 1955, we don't know how long this one is going to go on for. But when it does come to an end, do we have any idea of knowing how long we are safe for? By that, I mean, it's been over 50 years since the last one, but 5 years between the last two.
Yeah. Well, our best guide for this particular activity is actually what happened in 1924. There was a very similar event when there was a lava lake at the summit. The lava lake drained, just like it did for this event. There was no eruption of lava in 1924, but there was a very large intrusion of lava in about the same place as the eruptions happening today. And we know that because the ground was very heavily deformed and earthquakes were very strong. After that activity in 1924, there were about 10 years of very minor eruptions at the summit of Kilauea, and then 18 years of no eruptive activity at all. And that appears to be because the entire magmatic system of Kilauea drained because of this great intrusion of magma that happened in 1924. We're seeing something very similar play out now, where the summit of Kilauea is subsiding, it's depressurizing, it's draining. It's like someone pulled the plug on the bathtub. And so it seems likely that when all is said and done and this eruption finally ends, it will take a while to rebuild pressure, to refill Kilauea's system. We may be looking at a fairly substantial period, years perhaps, of no or only minor eruptive activity at Kilauea.
Fascinating stuff indeed. Michael, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Michael Poland, a research geophysicist with the Cascades Volcano Observatory. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0458, and you'll find links to their website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The 11th Commandment. Plus, we'll have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nellman. He'll be dropping by. We have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, crime can be easy, but sometimes it's just a little too easy. Court documents say someone filed a form and 24-year-old Deshaun Henderson Spruce, who says he did nothing wrong, started getting mail. Lots of mail. Letters meant for a major corporate executive, checks for large amounts of money, and several American Express cards. The mail, according to an application for a warrant to search Henderson Spruce's apartment, was addressed to package carrier UPS. But the form claimed Big Brown had changed its address from its headquarters building in Atlanta, Georgia, to a tiny apartment in Chicago, Illinois. The form was first signed HS, which was then scratched out, and then signed UPS. More than 2 months later, UPS realized something was up and alerted the postal inspectors. Eventually, Henderson Spruce was charged with mail theft and mail fraud. The same day Henderson Spruce's apartment was searched, bank investigators contacted postal inspectors to report upwards of $58,000 worth of checks made payable to UPS had been deposited to an account in Henderson Spruce's name. And you thought your UPS package took an odd route. Okay. There's a smidgen of ingenuity and a whole lot of chutzpah when you think you can pull off a crime just by redirecting the mail of a major corporation to your house. What can Brown do for you? Apparently a heck of a lot if you assume their corporate address. The Indian River County, Florida Sheriff's Office is pretty sure they got their man. They were called to a Walmart for a shoplifting case. A security guard had 28-year-old Darius Denard Reynolds in custody. Not only did Reynolds have 42 bottles of Heineken beer on him, but he also had the various elements of the disguise that the thief was wearing in a security camera video. A woman's dress, a pair of women's sandals, a wig, and a shower cap. Which, when you think about it, is just what a guy needs to blend in at a Florida Walmart. I don't know why they just don't change their corporate slogan to Walmart. Come for the low prices and the free floor show of crazy. Yeah. Anyway, here is proof positive that society as a whole has lost its sense of humor. An 18-year-old who put his suburban Kansas City high school for sale on Craigslist has been banned from graduation after the senior prank went awry. Kylan Scheel listed Truman High School in Independence, Missouri, for the bargain price of $12,275 last week. Problems arose when someone reported the posting as a possible threat because of Scheel's choice of wording. He wrote that the reason for the sale was, quote, the loss of students coming up. Scheel says he was describing the loss of students because they were graduating and has apologized, but he's been booted from commencement. District spokeswoman Jana Corey says significant hours were spent tracking down the post's source. She says police even issued an emergency subpoena to Craigslist before determining there wasn't a credible threat.
Oh my, significant hours were spent tracking down the post source. Boo bloody who.
Wow. Kylan, I see a bright future ahead of you. Have you thought of getting a job writing for The Onion, perhaps? You know, I'm so glad I wasn't educated in this time period. I mean, school doesn't remotely sound like it is any fun anymore. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. In Hudson, Florida, 47-year-old Brandon Donald McCray came unglued on May the 1st after discovering two of his socks missing. When suspicion fell on his 53-year-old roommate, Frank Smith, McCray attacked him with a sword. The attack continued as McCray also struck and injured two women living at the home. Pasco County Sheriff's deputies say Smith nearly lost several fingers trying to defend himself. Deputies arrested McCray at a neighbor's house on charges of attempted homicide and battery. This was over socks. This was over missing socks. Either Brandon must have had a traumatic situation in his childhood dealing with sock puppets, or he needs to switch to decaf. Eee. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Dr. David Trucker was a successful surgeon treating hundreds of regular patients while at the same time meeting the medical needs of mafia members, celebrities, and working undercover for police in the states of Minnesota, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. He was also a teenage gang leader who turned his life around after a conviction, achieving the rank of Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army. David has written his memoir called The 11th Commandment. He joins us on the line right now from Minnesota. Hi, David.
Hello, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. You've had such a varied life, and you can take any part of your life and turn it into a book, turn it into a memoir. How did you decide what to put into the book when you've had, like I said, such a rich life?
Well, I'll tell you, it took a lot of decision-making. I had over 400 notes, and I wrote the book over a six-month period of time. And actually, I was told by a filmmaker to put it in chronological order so they can consider possibly making a movie out of the whole thing. So that is why the format is set up on a chronological basis. And you're correct. I could take any segment. I could take the military career and elaborate on that. And by the way, I'm very thankful to the many Canadian soldiers who volunteered and were with me at Fort Huachuca in Arizona before their deployment. So we as Americans are very thankful for those about 25,000 Canadian volunteers. And the military was just one segment. I probably was able to really gain rank quite readily because of my personality and the way I had turned into a highly structured, disciplinary individual, which seemed to meet the needs of the Army, both during the Vietnam era and then subsequently during my deployment with NATO in Germany. So I would say you are correct. I could take any segment and write a book on it and probably just take specific incidents and elaborate upon them. And I didn't take time to do that. I didn't want to make the book so long that it would be agonizing. But as you know, it is a page turner and the details move very quickly. And probably subsequently, I will do segment elaboration.
Okay, well, let's go back a little bit. I mentioned one of the things early in your life, you were a teenage gang leader, not just a gang member, but a gang leader. How did that come to be?
Well, it came to be by accident. Actually, don't faint, but a nun told me about a problem that existed in a grade school where children, see, we didn't have school buses in those days, couldn't get to the Catholic school because of a gang that was harassing them and preventing them. So actually, I had about three guys initially involved with me. Our gang was called the Big Five, and I was the boss. And so we set up an elaborate plan, actually with a pyrogenic guy, and found the headquarters of the opposing gang and blew it up.
And where was this?
It occurred in outside Akron, Ohio, in a town, a suburb called Cayuga Falls. And Cayuga Falls has become well-known because of Rex Humbard and some of the other unique, both notorious and famous people that have come out of there.
Okay.
So anyway, that gave me a false sense of strength and superiority, which I capitalized on. And I had a cousin in Cleveland who was in the process of dividing up territory in Cleveland and Cleveland Heights to sell illegal cigarettes to underage kids. And he was a little chicken about the meeting and asked me to join him. And I did so. And when the issue came up, with him pointing a gun at me and saying, "This is the way it's going to be," I said, "Okay, I have a map here in my pocket, and I'll show you my suggestion for dividing up the territory. And instead of pulling out a map, I pulled out a .22 caliber snub nose, fired two shots. The first hit the wall. I was a lousy shot. And the second hit him in the shoulder. But let me tell you, that precipitated a major problem for which I was immediately classified as having experienced a felony. And because of my family, big political pressure in Cleveland, even though there were two charges, the first shooting the guy, I got out of that because he had a gun, but I couldn't get out of the charge of illegal possession of a weapon by a minor, and that's why I got sent away a long distance to Wisconsin to that Jesuit high school, which at the time happened to be the highest ranking academic high school in the nation. And although I hated it initially, I woke up to the fact, hey, kid, here's the time to turn your life around, and I did it.
Now, you went into the Army. You achieved the rank of lieutenant colonel in the United States Army. Again, earlier, as I mentioned, you were a teenage gang leader. It seems to be, it doesn't make a difference which side of the law you're on, it seems to be you're a natural leader.
Yes, that would seem to be quite evident. Yes. and I had various people describing my personality. I know the head nurse at the base where I was during the Vietnam era, when asked by the commanding general in that area what my behavior and control was like, and she said very frankly, he's the most organized son of a bitch I ever met in my life. And the general laughed, and but he got the message. And in the book I talk about a couple other things too, which I don't want to go into on radio, but describe how the corpsman that worked for me and all described me. And I think it's important to know, though, that there was a reason. We had a draft, as you know, in the Vietnam War. The recruits, not recruits, the poor guys had to go to basic training first, and if they were considered capable of handling weapons, they went into the infantry. If they weren't capable of handling weapons or had other problems, they went to other specialties, particularly the medical corps. So I would end up with about 100 of these kids who really weren't what I would call the top of the deck. And my job was to keep them alive and get them back to mommy and daddy. And to do that, I had to be their daddy. And I wasn't the sweetest of all daddies.
Well, there's so much we can talk about. We didn't even discuss how you became a surgeon. People will just have to read the book to find that out. And also how you not only saw the needs of celebrities, as I mentioned in the introduction, but mafia members. I guess that's something people will have to read the book to find out how you did that all. But I will ask one last question before we let you go, and that is, when you look back at your career, when you look back at your life, both the good things and the bad things, it all brings us to who you are today. So having said that, would you change anything that has happened in your life?
oh, yes. I wouldn't do the nut thing that I did when I was a teenager. That's for sure. I think the important thing to learn from the book is accountability. What whatever we do in life, we must be accountable for. And I think teenage boys need to learn that. Accountability is critical. You do good things and they pay off. You do bad things and you're going to pay a different way. So accountability is the word that I think is most critical as far as a learning lesson from the book.
That probably could mean a lot about the commandment or the title of your book, which is the 11th commandment. Interesting words and words I'm sure a lot of people can take heed to, especially after reading and learning about your varied life and career. David, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Dr. David Trucker, author of The 11th Commandment. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0458, and you'll find links to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In recent years, we've learned that living in the most lawsuit-happy society on Earth has imposed a hidden lawsuit tax on consumers. It doesn't appear on the bills we get, but it's built into the cost of everything we buy. That's not the only hidden tax paid by American consumers, though. There's also a regulatory hidden tax that's imposed by the government bureaucracy instead of the courts. According to the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., the total cost of complying with all the federal regulations each year is $1.9 trillion. To put that into perspective, complying with regulations costs more than all the money the federal government collects from individual and corporate income taxes combined. Let's be fair, the cost of regulation is enormous, but it is slowing. In President Trump's first year in office, fewer new federal regulations were created than any year since 1976. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And on his literary treadmill, we have once again Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu. Who are you chasing this week?
Well, it's not... I'm chasing Hillary.
Ah!
Clinton, that is.
Have you checked the woods?
I haven't been near, their home in New York State. Haven't checked those woods yet.
Okay. There have been sightings.
Oh, there have?
Oh, there have been sightings, yes.
Oh, yes? Have you spoken to Leonard Nimoy in that show In Search Of?
I think his replacement, Zachary Quinto, will be bringing that up. What are we talking about today?
Well, we're going to talk about a book on about Hillary Clinton. But the story behind how and why Hillary Clinton lost this divisive, volatile 2016 U.S. presidential election campaign to Donald Trump. And it's quite a fascinating story. And it has already been the subject of two best-selling books, one from the candidate's point of view herself called What Happened, and from two of Hillary's senior campaign workers, it was called Shattered. And now there's another book that takes an inside look at Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign. That was definitely hers to lose. However, this time it's from the viewpoint from one of the girls on the bus. The press bus, that is. And for New York Times reporter Amy Chozick's book, Chasing Hillary, it's a story of how a veteran politician and former first lady tried to break the political glass ceiling to become the first woman elected president of the United States, as told by a woman who spent most of her career breaking the glass ceiling of the male-dominated world of journalism in general and political journalism in particular. So for starters, Chasing Hillary is an example of trenchcoat journalism and history on the run reporting at its best that ranks up there with Timothy Krause's Boys on the Bus and Richard Ben Kramer's What It Takes. Now, the book is a quasi-diary of Chozick's on-the-road accounts of covering Clinton's 2008 and 2016 presidential campaigns, everything from those endless trail of cookie-cutter chain hotels, crisscrossing the country by car and plane until In 2016, Clinton's people were generous enough to splurge on a campaign bus, a press bus, at the latter part of the 2016 campaign. Those never-ending stops in every small town in America, the snooty and at times uncooperative campaign staffers, and the stressful quest of getting scoops and meeting deadlines. And the impression the reader gets when they finish this book was that Hillary Clinton was a two-time train wreck in a pantsuit just waiting to happen. She comes off as a person whose intentions were genuine in theory, but became less genuine with every campaign appearance. One vivid example of this is Hillary's coterie of staffers trying to make her look genuine in the eyes of the media and potential voters during a stop at the Iowa State Fair, where staffers scrambled to have her eat a corn dog so that she could be seen as a candidate of the people.
Oh, that's never a good idea. No, 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 no. The photo op of that is just wrong on so many levels.
Maybe a fried Snickers bar would probably have done better.
No, 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 no. There are certain photo ops in politics you should never do. Eating a corn dog is one of them.
Well, maybe that was a miscalculation on her staffer's part.
Even worse, eating a corn dog as a woman. No. No, no, no.
Okay, next time we'll stick with maybe pancakes or waffles or something like that. And to make matters more difficult for Chosnick and her job of covering Clinton, she and the candidate never really got along from the offset. And that's thanks mainly to the pieces she wrote about Clinton in the New York Times that she thought were unflattering at the very least. Especially one piece that was written late in the campaign that dealt with why Hillary was spending most of her time during this crucial period attending high-profile fundraising events instead of being on the campaign trail. But what I enjoyed about this book is Chosnick's caustic, take-no-prisoners narrative, which almost echoes that old-school type of political journalism that you might have read about 50 or 60 years ago. And there's plenty of sarcastic humor as well, especially as she gives a lot of code names to her media colleagues and campaign flunkies that she's encountered on the road, like Hired Gun Guy, The Guys, Policy Guy, Brown Loafers, Original Guy, and even Hillary doesn't escape this codename treatment from Chosnick, but she gets a most polite one called FWP, or First Woman President.
I was about to ask, I'm sure Amy was working on this book or had the idea for this book as she was traveling along with the candidate with the anticipation that Hillary was going to win.
Yes.
So is there an epilogue to this book, without giving the end of it away? Is there an epilogue in this book that points to what went wrong, or at what point did it go wrong, or when she felt it was going to go wrong?
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of that in the narrative itself, in the text. You don't need an afterword, you know, to say what went wrong. It basically takes you along the trail of what did go wrong. As you read along during her during that practically year long endurance test on the campaign trail. So when the paperback edition comes out, I don't think there's a need for an afterword. It's already in there.
Okay. So the book is?
Okay. Well, the book is called Chasing Hillary, and it's by Amy Chosnick. Terrific book, actually. I think it's a great campaign book. It's published by Harper, and it's $34.99.
And what books do you recommend in this vein? Although I almost loathe to say that, because there are way too many books out about this particular campaign on both sides of the aisle. It almost makes me think that I might want to read a Gordon Lightfoot book.
Yeah.
Almost. Almost.
Well, I'm going to spare you on that one, Peter. I'm going to mention the four books I mentioned just now. Shattered by Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. That's the book by the two campaign workers. I do recommend What Happened, so you get that point of view. Boys on the Bus by Timothy Krause. What It Takes by Richard Van Kramer. And also, if you want the classic presidential campaign book of a winning campaign, always go for Theodore H. White's The Making of the President, 1960.
Wow. Okay. So again, this week's book is?
Called Chasing Hillary by Amy Chosnick. It's published by Harper, and it's $34.99. It almost sounds like a Walt Disney film, actually, or a Pixar animated feature.
No, it's a Lifetime movie is what it is. And for those out there who want to be chasing Stewart, where can they find you?
Well, you're not going to find me at the Iowa State Fair, that's for sure.
Or in a pantsuit, I may add.
Oh, no, no, definitely not. But you could find me actually on the pages of the Montreal Times every week in print, every Saturday, or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter, and I'm on the road again.
Stuart Ullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about into the home stretch here on this edition of the Stuff File program. Since we were just talking about books with Stuart Ullman, let me remind you about my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. It's still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons like Buddy Epson, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and the ever-popular Much, Much More. And two guys who left their footprints on the moon. And I want to mention that in a moment. Check it out. It's available on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. And you'll find links to the book at our website on TheStuffFile.com. So buy the book. What are you waiting for? And as I mentioned, the subtitle of the book, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, it just so happens one of those men passed away this past weekend. Alan Bean, who was the fourth man to walk on the moon, died at the age of 86. Not only was he an amazing astronaut, an amazing flyer, an amazing commander, but he was also an amazing artist and a really nice man, and he was a joy to talk to. So on the next edition, next week's edition of the Stuff File program, I'll play you some of that interview with Alan Bean in memory of a man who was a giant among a select few. Only 12 men walked on the moon, and he was one of those 12. A really, really nice guy, Alan Bean, who passed away this past weekend at the age of 86. And again, next week, you'll hear a segment with Alan Bean from the original interview I did, which is contained in my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. So stick around for that next week on the Stuff File program. Anyway, back to the Stuff File news. April 11th was a great day for 40-year-old Markiko Sonny Lewis of Maple Heights, Ohio. He got out of jail. Lewis served time in state prison for robbing a Cleveland Key Bank branch in November 2015. To celebrate, he returned to the same bank on April 12th and robbed it again, taking about $1,000. Lewis was indicted on May 1st with one count of bank robbery. You know, there's that popular definition of insanity, you know the one, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. You can't deny that this is a case that truly applies. I had some serious thoughts of making him the idiot of the day, but I didn't. That comes in a matter of moments. Police in Lorach, Germany, responded May 14th to complaints about a domestic disturbance after a neighbor reported a loud confrontation that had been going on for some time. But when they arrived, they found a 22-year-old man arguing with his girlfriend's parrot. The parrot had been barking like a dog, and the man became annoyed with it. No charges were filed. Yes, a grown-ass man arguing with a bird and apparently losing the argument. This is a man with issues, and also a man who at no moment should become a parent. That's apparently clear. Anyway, boys and girls, this is the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
The Broward Sheriff's Office has arrested one of their own after a deputy was accused of shoplifting at a Walmart in Lauderdale Lakes, all while still in uniform. Investigators arrested Deputy Henry Guzman, a 13-year veteran of the department. According to the Police Public Corruption Unit, they teamed up with Walmart after they received information that Guzman was stealing from the large retailer. Investigators said over the course of 3 days, Guzman entered the Walmart and stole DVDs and Star Wars action figures. Seriously? Star Wars action figures? Well, he did it all in uniform, said Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel. Walmart said the total of the loss was about $200. Guzman was charged with 3 misdemeanor counts of petty theft. Now, why? Oh, why would you shoplift from the same Walmart store not once, not twice, but 3 days in a row? And oh, yeah, why? Oh, why? While you're doing this, would you be doing it while wearing your police officer's uniform? Wow, one reason and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0458. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0458. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.